From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. What if you had a rare disease almost certain to kill you and your doctors told you there's no cure? David Fagenbaum was diagnosed with Castleman disease when he was a 25-year-old medical student, and after nearly dying in the hospital several times, he decided he'd have to try and find his own treatment. His new book tells the story of how he did that, in part by building a worldwide network of doctors, scientists, and patients to crowdsource the most promising research and treatments. That collaborative effort is now turning its attention to COVID-19, which Fagenbaum says has characteristics in common with Castleman disease. His book is called Chasing My Cure. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Benjamin Taylor's memoir about his friendship with Philip Roth. Our guest, David Fagenbaum, nearly died in a hospital 5 times. He was a medical student in his 20s when he was diagnosed with an obscure but deadly disease that was little understood, one for which his doctors had no cure and little in the way of treatment. After coming to death's door for the 5th time, he decided to search for a treatment himself. His story is remarkable both because of the results of his search, which you'll soon hear about, but also because of the approach he took, crowdsourcing the medical knowledge and experience with his illness around the world to find the most promising treatment. The organization he formed to connect the dots of knowledge about his disease is now applying its techniques to the quest for a treatment for COVID-19. David Fagenbaum is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and the associate director for the Orphan Disease Center. And he's co-founder and executive director of the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network. His book about his experience is Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. I spoke to him from my home in Philadelphia. David Fagenbaum, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Now, you didn't get the illness that's the subject of all this until, I guess, you were 25. You were a high school quarterback and then went to Georgetown University, where you were also quarterback of the football team. But early in your college years, you lost your mom to brain cancer. Just tell us how that affected you and how you responded to that loss.
Her illness and passing just devastated me. It took me from a world and a life where I focused on football and I thought maybe I wanted to go into medicine, to a world and a life where all I wanted to do was become a doctor and to chase after diseases like cancer. My mom was the most incredible person in the world, and she taught me so much throughout my life, but in particular throughout her illness, about how to live the right way. And she motivated me to want to focus my life on helping patients like her.
You also formed an organization to help college students grieving with a loss.
That's right. Just a couple weeks before my mom passed away, we had our final conversation, and it was the first time that we had ever thought and talked about this being the end. And she was really worried about if I would be okay, if I could cope with her illness while and her now passing while I was at college. And I promised her, I said, "Mom, I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to dedicate my life towards fighting diseases like cancer and helping other young people dealing with the illness or death of a loved one." And she just loved the idea. She couldn't say too many words, but she said unconditional love. And I went back to college and I was completely on a mission. She passed away the end of October, and within just a few weeks, I started an organization called AMF. My mom's initials were Anne Marie Fagenbaum, and I started this group called Ailing Mothers and Fathers for students that were dealing with the illness or death of a loved one. And it was a way to continue her memory. She was such an amazing person, and I just felt that her legacy needed to continue, and her life of supporting others needed to continue on to help other college students coping with the illness or death of a loved one.
You were a medical student and you'd done a few rotations when this disease, that's the subject of all this, hit you. How did it present itself?
I was a healthy third-year medical student. I was really on my way to that new thing that I was fighting for. First it was football, and now all of a sudden I was fighting to take on disease and to fight cancer. And all of a sudden I started noticing I was more tired than usual. I noticed I had some really severe abdominal pain. I noticed lumps and bumps in my neck. Didn't know what all of it meant, but I just felt like I could put it off until after the rotation that I was on. I was on an OBGYN rotation and just kept thinking, you know, this can wait. And unfortunately, over the next few days, I got more and more tired, and the abdominal pain got worse. And I just felt really, really unwell. I even told a couple of my friends that I thought I was dying, which I'm not a very dramatic person, so I clearly knew something was going wrong. But after I took my medical school exam, I went down the hall to the emergency department, and they ran some blood tests. And I'll never forget the doctor coming in the room and saying, "David, your liver, your kidneys, your bone marrow, your heart, and your lungs are shutting down. We have to hospitalize you right away." And they did. And over the course of the next few days, I became deathly ill. They admitted me to the intensive care unit, where I had a retinal hemorrhage that made me blind in my left eye. I gained 70 pounds of fluid, drifted in and out of consciousness, and required transfusions just to keep me alive, all with no diagnosis. And unfortunately, it would go on for a lot longer.
You're going through all this, and there's still no diagnosis. You know, you write that well before the symptoms were at their worst, you knew you were dying. You were sure of it. Why, do you think?
It's hard to put into words the fatigue that I was feeling, the pain that I was feeling. I'd been sick before, just like all of us, with flus and illnesses, but the sick that I felt was an illness like it's hard to describe, and it just felt different from anything else I'd ever experienced. And something was telling me that it was really, really, really bad, and I frankly didn't think I was going to survive.
What do you make of this now? All of your organs were shutting down in some way. You kind of knew that, but with the experience of several years and serious hospitalizations, now what do you make of this sense that you were dying?
At the very basic level, I think it was that I was feeling so unwell that I just sensed that this must be what it feels like to be dying. Now that, as you said, I've undergone this experience five times, it truly is the pain of organ failure, the confusion of having your liver and your kidneys not cleaning your blood so your brain doesn't work appropriately. It was all of these physiological things happening at once, but I think it was also just the fear of knowing that this likely meant that I would not be around much longer.
So you spent 4 weeks in the hospital in Philadelphia, where you were in medical school, and then transferred to a hospital in Raleigh, North Carolina, where your dad, who was also a physician, had worked. You eventually got better and were released after 7 weeks after, I guess, heavy treatment of corticosteroids, right? But still no diagnosis.
That's right. No diagnosis. And I knew that I had just gone through this life-threatening near-death experience where at one point the doctors didn't think I would survive, and my friends and family came in the room to say their goodbyes. And all of a sudden, here we are 7 weeks later, and I'm just kind of mysteriously, miraculously getting better with no diagnosis. And I wasn't really satisfied with this idea of let's just hope that it doesn't come back, a number of my doctors had told me. And so when I got out of the hospital, I tried to get all of my medical records that I could and see if I could piece together what was going on. I was only a third year medical student, but I hoped that maybe I could find some pattern that my doctors couldn't. Unfortunately, I did not figure out the pattern before I was back in the hospital just a few weeks later, again, with all the same symptoms as before.
A few weeks after you had your first bout with what was then a mysterious illness, you know, you're back in the hospital in North Carolina going through the same horrific stuff again. And you want them to do a test for lymphoma. It comes back. You don't have lymphoma, but they have some other news. Tell us about this.
Yeah, they came back and told me that it's not lymphoma, and this healthcare professional was actually smiling. She was so happy. And I was so happy it wasn't lymphoma because we were worried that it was. And she said, I've never heard of it before, but you have idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease. And I had remembered vaguely hearing it once before in med school, but I really didn't remember much about this disease. But I was just so happy that it wasn't lymphoma. And so so she left the room, and this happened to be the first time in weeks that I was alone in the hospital room. My dad and my sisters never left my side. They just so happened to not be in the room at this time. And so I pulled out my phone and I Googled it, and I was terrified. I found this one study on the Wikipedia page that basically said that 80% of patients don't live for 2 years after diagnosis. And so our greatest fear about it being lymphoma, actually lymphoma's survival rates are better than what I was reading on this Wikipedia page about this disease. And I knew that it was bad. I mean, I had experienced multi-organ failure. I knew this was a bad disease, whatever it was that I was facing. But I had hoped it wasn't as bad as idiopathic multicenter Castleman disease is. And one of the reasons I soon learned for why this disease has such poor outcomes is because so little was known about the disease by the medical community.
Right. It sort of has characteristics of cancer and characteristics of immune disorder. You discover that there's actually an expert on Castleman, Dr. Fritz Van Rie, who's at the University of Arkansas. You contact him, and he agrees to see you, so you're going to head down there and talk to the person who seems to know the most about it. I love this. You decide you have to get some new clothes. Why?
Yeah, I had such a large belly from all of the fluid accumulation that I couldn't fit into any of my previous clothes. And so I needed to get basically triple XL outfits so that way I could actually fit into my clothes. And actually, even just right around the time that I finally got this diagnosis, The real challenge was then, well, what do you do? You might have idiopathic multicenter Castleman disease, but what do you do now? And I was transferred to Duke University Hospital, the same hospital that my mom had received all of her treatment at. And I remember passing by this sign, at Duke, there is hope. And I remember when I had seen that sign before with my mom's treatment, I had been so, so hopeful. And of course, she had passed battling her cancer. And so all of a sudden, seeing it again didn't give me the same sort of hope that I had gotten from seeing that sign before. But thankfully, the doctors there gave me chemotherapy. And thankfully, they gave it to me just in time because I was so sick when they started administering chemotherapy to me that my doctors encouraged my family to come in and say their goodbyes. And now for the second time, and my family had a priest come in and administer my last rites to me. So back in November of 2010, I was prepared to die by a priest with having my last rites read to me. And I've really considered that moment when a priest came in and administered my last rites to me to kind of be the start of my overtime, extra time that I didn't think that I would have, but time that I'm trying to make the most of.
Right. Now, they give you these heavy doses of chemotherapy. They still don't understand what causes the disease. How does the chemotherapy help?
You're exactly right. So when you don't know what to target, so if you don't know what cell type is the problem or what mechanisms are involved in the disease, you can just kill everything. And that's kind of the approach with multi-agent chemotherapy, because the medical community didn't know what to go after. The approach is, well, let's just kind of nuke everything with chemotherapy. And that's what they did for me. And as barbaric as it sounds, it saved my life. And I'm alive today because of this, you know, just nuke everything approach with a combination of 7 different chemotherapies.
Right, but the drawback is you know that you can't keep doing this forever, right?
That's exactly right. There's a lifetime max of these drugs. There is only so much you can take before they actually start causing irreversible organ damage, cancers. There are so many side effects of this. So this is not a permanent solution, but it was what we needed at the time to save my life the second and then the third time.
You end up going to Arkansas, where Dr. Fritz Van Rie, it turns out, is one of the national experts in Castleman disease. And I love this little story where you're, I guess, taking the shuttle from the airport And the driver looks at you and says, what?
He looks at me, he says, you have Castleman disease, right? And I'm like, wait a minute. I had been at some of the best medical centers in the world and no one could figure out what disease I had. And all of a sudden, here I am, and the shuttle bus driver is telling me that I have Castleman disease. And I think that, first off, because the world's expert for Castleman disease is in Little Rock, Arkansas, they get a lot of Castleman disease patients. And secondly, Castleman's patients, because all of our organs shut down, including our liver and our kidneys, we gain tons and tons of fluid everywhere. And so I think that me being so puffy and in my triple XL sweatshirt that you had asked about earlier, I think that he just must have recognized that I looked like a Castleman disease patient, and he was totally right.
Yeah, and it's kind of an interesting metaphor for the problem with, you know, these obscure illnesses, is that you can have people in one place, even a shuttle driver, who recognizes its symptoms because it's known some places, but medical experts elsewhere may never have heard of it. Right?
That's exactly right. When you have over 10,000 different diseases, you can't expect every doctor to know everything about every disease. But that's not actually the problem. The problem isn't that every doctor doesn't know everything about every disease. The problem is that for some diseases, no doctors know anything about those diseases. And Castleman disease, it really falls more into that category, where there are just a few physicians and researchers who really have much of an understanding at all, at least back in 2010, about the disease.
So I want to move the story forward a bit here. You were, you'd been treated for several attacks of Castleman, and you talked to a national expert, and they found that there was one promising drug on a clinical trial, and you took that, siltuximab, something
That's
like
right.
that? Okay. You go on that, and you're hoping that you're better, right? You spend some time not, you know, believing that maybe regular treatments with this drug are really going to solve the problem. Turns out it doesn't. April 2012, it's back, a roaring attack of this dreadful set of symptoms. And in the middle of this, you realize medicine just doesn't have an answer, and you decide you're going to take this on yourself. And in doing so, you kind of learn some things about how medical research does and doesn't work. You looked at the state of knowledge about Castleman. What did you discover? What were the problems?
When I set out to begin to understand, well, what's being done, what's been done in the past, what's being done right now, I learned that, just as you mentioned, there was very little that was being done. The few people that were working were not working with one another, and that research was very random. I think previously I assumed that there was infrastructure and plans and goals and objectives within fields, but what I learned is that actually research happens quite randomly, where you have to basically hope that the right researcher applies for the right project and the right funding with the right skill set at the right time. And when you have a deadly illness, you don't really have time for all of those stars to align. And so I learned pretty quickly that the most important thing that I could do would be to actually try to align the stars, to actually try to get all of these problems, solutions, resources lined up so that we could make as much progress as quickly as we could.
What's interesting about it is that a lot of this was just organizational, right? Because there were scraps of knowledge a lot of places. I mean, dozens, scores, maybe hundreds of people, doctors who had tried treatments, patients who had gone through things, some studies, but it wasn't centralized anywhere and people weren't talking to each other. How did you solve this organizational problem, or try to?
It wasn't easy, but the way that we started out to try to solve this problem was that we first tried to identify all the physicians, researchers, and patients worldwide who knew anything about Castleman disease. We wanted to just first find everyone and then connect them online through a virtual discussion board and then eventually through in-person meetings. But the idea was that if we could get everyone together, then we could crowdsource from them. We could ask the whole community what research questions are important, and we could ask patients what research questions are important to you. And then we could go out and we can figure out who's the best person in the world to do the studies to answer those questions. And just to kind of give some contrast, the typical way that this works is that a research group raises money and then invites researchers to apply to use the money how they see fit. And so for a rare disease, you might get a few people that apply for that funding. And we said, well, let's not just wait and hope that those couple of people will apply for the right idea and have the right background. Let's figure out what is the right study that needs to be done and who is the right person to do it. And then we'll go and recruit them into the field. We'll go and find someone who's studying another disease and get them into the Castleman's field and get them to work on this. And really importantly, as we do this research, we also will relentlessly ask what drugs are already FDA approved that might actually have activity against this disease based on what we're learning about the disease. Because we knew that to develop a brand new drug from scratch would take a decade and billions of dollars. But we knew that if we could learn more about this disease and then identify a drug that already exists, that's already available, that's FDA approved for another condition, then we could be thinking about treating this disease in a matter of months as opposed to decades.
David Fagenbaum is assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. We'll hear more of his story after a short break. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Benjamin Taylor's memoir about his friendship with Philip Roth. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Capital One, you can earn 5 times the national average savings rate, so you can save confidently knowing that your money is growing in a safe place every day. Capital One is helping you earn more towards your savings goals. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
We're speaking with University of Pennsylvania Assistant Medical Professor David Fagenbaum. At the age of 25, he was diagnosed with Castleman disease, a rare, deadly illness with no known cure. After nearly dying in the hospital several times, Fagenbaum set out to try and find his own treatment. He started the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, a patient-centered effort to crowdsource the most promising research, an organization that's now focused on treatments for COVID-19. His book about the experience is called Chasing My Cure. You get your 5th attack of Castleman while all this work is going on, and you decide you're just going to take charge of your own treatment now. And, you know, I'm just going to tell listeners that this is a fascinating part of the story. And in the book, what we really see is you going through some detective work. I mean, it's almost like a Sherlock Holmes thing. And it's a little too long and involved to get through all of it here. But in the book, you can follow it. You manage to look back at your own history of the disease, get all the records from all the hospitals you've been to, even specimens that might still exist. And you come up with something. You want to just describe what you did in layman's terms?
Sure. So just as you said, I had been collecting samples on myself, blood samples, and then also lymph node tissue from a procedure during that relapse. And this is now the 5th time that I was dying in the hospital, that I spent weeks in the hospital with multi-organ failure. And I didn't know if I would survive. In fact, I didn't think I would, but I knew that if I did survive, that I would need these samples because I would need to be able to use the samples from when I was sick to try to find something that could maybe save my life. The biggest difference between this 5th time I nearly died and in the previous 4 times is that at this stage I was engaged and I had the ultimate date in mind, which is our wedding date, May 24th, 2014, in mind as the driver to say, I need to find something. I failed to respond to all these drugs. There's nothing left for me, but I have to make it to May 24th, 2014. And so thankfully, this combination of 7 chemotherapies saved my life. And when I got out of the hospital, I was able to go back to all those samples I'd been storing on myself and performed a series of experiments where from within my experiments, I found this pattern that suggested this one communication line in the immune system called the mTOR pathway was highly activated. And what was so exciting about finding this communication line turned on is that there is a drug that was developed 30 years ago that's really good at turning it off. It's called sirolimus. And just knowing that this pathway was on did not guarantee that blocking it would work and that taking this drug would save my life. In fact, the immune system is a very finicky system, and basically turning off this communication line could have actually caused even more problems. No one knew because this drug had never been given to a Castleman disease patient before. But really knowing that I needed to try something if I wanted to make it to our wedding date, I decided to take the leap of faith and to start taking this drug as the first patient with my disease ever to take sirolimus back in early 2014. And amazingly, thankfully, I was able to make it to Caitlin and I's wedding date. And you wouldn't think this is too important, Dave, but my hair grew back just in time, and it was still very short. It looked kind of like a buzz cut, but that was actually really, really important to us. I wanted on my wedding day to just look like Dave, and to not have that external reminder of the bald head from chemotherapy. So it was really special that I had my hair back on my wedding day.
So this is amazing. I mean, you discover that this pattern by looking at your own records and specimens carefully, there's this cellular communication line, and there's a drug which can treat it, sirolimus. It works. And so it's been how long since you've had an attack that you've been on this drug?
It's been 76.26 months since my last relapse. And I say 76.26 months because I literally keep track of it daily, and because I realize that I can't round up. I don't know if I'm going to make it to 77 months, but I also refuse to round down. My team and my family supported me so much to be able to make it to where I am. So it's 76.26 months.
So this drug, sirolimus, was it like hiding in plain sight?
I think that's a good way to describe it. It was already FDA approved. It was sitting in every pharmacy that I had ever walked past during the first 3.5 years of my illness. It took the work that my colleagues and I did, the collaborative network, the crowdsourcing, to be able to figure this drug out as a potential solution. And now we've given it to other Castleman's patients, and we have a clinical trial open right now.
Now, this off-label use of FDA-approved drugs can be terrific. It's also controversial, right? I mean, we had the president suggesting that people who have COVID-19 try hydroxychloroquine, and there was, in fact, a story Monday in the Philadelphia Inquirer about nursing homes in Pennsylvania that had been widely treating its nursing home patients with hydroxychloroquine. What sort of rules governed the use of these kinds of things? When you wanted to use sirolimus for Castleman, did you need some approval in order to use it?
So it's actually quite interesting, the off-label drug use landscape. So once a drug gets approved by the FDA for one disease, it can then be prescribed for any disease that a doctor wants to prescribe that drug for. So once it gets that initial indication, it can be used in many ways. There are no restrictions that the FDA or any other governing bodies put on what you can use drugs for. The biggest rate limiting step is whether it will get paid for. So whether the insurance company will say, oh, sure, I will pay to have sirolimus used for Castleman's, even though it's never been used before for Castleman disease. So it comes down to whether it'll actually get paid for. Most of the time, insurance companies will say, wait a minute, this has never been used before. There's no data. We're not going to pay for it. But if you can make the case to the insurance company or to the payer that this drug has a rationale for why it may work, it is a safe drug, and it's potentially less expensive than the alternative. And in my case, that was months-long hospitalizations, chemotherapy that are extremely expensive. Then sometimes the payer will agree to pay for that particular drug. What's really unfortunate is that when drugs are used off-label, there is no sort of tracking system to track whether they work or don't work. And currently, there are estimates as high as 30% of all prescription drugs are actually for off-label uses. So there is a lot of off-label prescription writing that occurs. Unfortunately, there's no sort of systematic tracking when things work, when things don't work. And as a result, you're constantly in a state of limited data. And I think that's why we are all such big proponents for randomized controlled trials. So if drugs are used off label, we need to track them systematically, and we have to make sure that that doesn't get in the way of doing really, really well-controlled clinical trials to be able to prove whether these drugs really work or not.
Now, people are going to know, because of the network that you've established, people who are interested in Castleman will know about sirolimus and its effect on you. This does not, it is, as it turns out, represent a cure for everyone with Castleman, does it?
That's right. So up until now, there have been somewhere around 20 or 25 Castleman disease patients that have been treated with sirolimus, and about 1/3 of those patients have improved. And so, unfortunately, 2/3 have not. I think about patients like Joey, who was dying in the ICU at a children's hospital, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, right next door to us, who had this miraculous response to sirolimus, which was amazing. And I think about patients like Lisa in Colorado, who didn't respond to first or second line therapy and didn't respond to sirolimus and passed away. And it's patients like Lisa that we think about all the time. We're thrilled for the patients like Joey, but we really, really work day in and day out for the patients like Lisa where this drug doesn't work, because it's helped to save some of us, but there are still many of us that need solutions. There are about 5,000 patients diagnosed each year in the U.S. with Castleman disease, and not only do these drugs have important relevance, obviously, for us with Castleman disease, but actually the cytokine storm and what's happening in patients with Castleman disease is almost identical to the cytokine storm that we're seeing in COVID-19. And many of these drugs that we're using for Castleman disease have now become drugs that we're using against COVID-19.
David Fagenbaum's book is Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We're spending more time at home than ever before. So now's a great time to finally adopt a dog, right?
Socialization is going to be harder because socialization and social distancing are definitely at odds.
So before you decide to adopt a canine companion during quarantine, listen and subscribe to NPR's Life Kit.
We're speaking with Dr. David Fagenbaum, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is about his battle with an obscure but deadly illness, Castleman disease, and his decision to search for a treatment himself by building an organization to effectively crowdsource medical experience and research about the illness from around the world. His book is called Chasing My Cure. So the collaborative that you formed to try and share information and leads about treating Castleman is now focused on COVID-19. I mean, this is obviously an urgent public health matter. Did you see similarities between Castleman disease and COVID-19 that made this a good fit?
That's right. So early on in this pandemic, it became clear that the most deadly aspect of COVID-19 is actually the cytokine storm that the virus ignites. And the cytokine storm that it ignites is almost identical.
You want to explain what a cytokine is?
Sure. So cytokines are proteins that your immune system releases to help to both fight off infections, but also to communicate to other immune cells to basically ramp up, get activated, and to go into a fight mode. And so in Castleman disease, there are very, very high levels of these cytokines, which cause our immune systems to get out of control and attack our vital organs. The exact same thing happens in COVID-19. So there's the virus appears, and when the virus is there, the immune system begins to attack it by producing these cytokines. But actually, it's the high level of cytokines that cause all of the organ damage and the deadliness of the virus. It's not actually the virus itself. And so with this similarity between at the very basic mechanism, what drives the deadliness of COVID-19 is almost identical to what makes Castleman disease so deadly. It's the cytokine storm. That was one aspect of it. The second is that we know that drug repurposing is our best shot at identifying a drug that can help patients in the short term. So a drug that's either already FDA approved or a drug that is maybe experimental but is not yet approved for anything that could be repurposed for COVID-19. We knew that was our best shot. And Dave, I found myself in early March thinking to myself, I really hope that some research group out there that has experience studying cytokine storms and has experience doing drug repurposing will follow our blueprint and search for drugs that can be repurposed against this cytokine storm. And I was sitting there hoping that someone would do it. And then I realized that I needed to listen to my own advice, and that if I'm going to hope that some research lab out there that has experience with cytokine storms and repurposing would turn their effort towards this, then I would need to turn my effort towards this. This is what we've been doing to chase my cure for these years. And we felt like we needed to do what we could in the fight against COVID-19.
So what exactly did your network do?
Sure. So we really have taken this problem on from two angles, again, similar to the path that we took to identify a drug for me and for other Castleman's patients. The first is recognizing that if you're going to do any drug repurposing, and if drugs are going to be tried against a disease, you have to systematically track every use of every drug to see whether it works and whether it doesn't work. I mean, you can basically think about the state that we're in right now is that doctors are trying all kinds of things, hydroxychloroquine, remdesivir, and many other drugs. Yet there's no system in place to track what's working and what's not working. And so recognizing that this wasn't being done, we decided to build a database, what we call the Corona database, COVID-19 registry of off-label and new agents. So it's a database to track all of the drugs that have been used against COVID-19 to date, because we want to know everything that's been tried and we want to see what's working and what's not working. And amazingly, almost 150 different drugs have already been tried against COVID-19. And of course, we hear about a handful of them, but there are a lot of others that have already been tried as well. And so we've created this giant database from right now, it's over 11,000 patients and growing to collect data on every drug that's been used, and so that we can really dig into what's working and what's not working. And the second part of this equation is that you want to track what's being used, but then you also want to piece together all of the data that's emerging from labs around the world to try to map out what are maybe some new drugs that we could start trying to use. What are some new pathways from all of this data that we should start going after? And interestingly, from this data, we're finding signals that are Castleman-like. Basically, a number of the features that we're seeing in the COVID-19 data, these same features we see in Castleman disease. And one of the most promising drugs that's currently undergoing a randomized controlled trial is a drug called tocilizumab. Tocilizumab was developed 30 years ago by a Castleman's doctor, a friend of mine named Kazu Yoshizaki. And amazingly, early on in this COVID-19 epidemic, it became clear that this particular cytokine, interleukin-6, is actually very, very elevated in the most sick COVID patients, and people started trying tocilizumab. And so this drug is now being studied through a number of randomized controlled trials, but this drug developed for Castleman disease years ago is now being repurposed against COVID-19 and one of our most promising drugs on our list.
Hmm. You know, I read that the team in your network scoured over 2,500 published papers already. So there's a lot of information out there if someone can manage to collect it and draw meaning from it. So you found this one drug, tocilizumab, which, you know, might be promising. Will you get attention? I mean, you know, there are zillions of words published every day about this epidemic and treatments. Are you concerned that your work might get overlooked?
You know, what we really want to do with this Corona project is to map out everything that's being tried, to put in one place all of the studies that are being published, all of the data on every drug that's being tried, so that other people can go to it and they can kind of decide for themselves what looks promising and what doesn't. We didn't build this to say this is the drug and that's not the drug. We built this to say this is where all the data is. If anyone wants to use the data, we have this very data-first approach. Anyone can use the data. And from our perspective, we want to use the data to determine and to prioritize what drugs should go on to clinical trials. So The fact is that this drug is already being studied in randomized controlled trials, and that's all that we can really ask for. We want to use the database to say what's being given, what looks really promising, and what should go forward to randomized controlled trial. We don't want to use the database to say this drug should be given or that drug should not be given. So we're hopeful, and actually we put together a paper based on our first passive analyses of the data and recently received favorable reviews. So hoping that that'll get published in a peer-reviewed journal shortly and that we will be able to get the word out about this database. But the goal is not to say this is the drug that everyone should be on. The goal is to say these are the promising drugs. Let's make sure that we don't forget anything along the way. Because you're right, I think that we all have a tendency to jump on every major drug or every major headline, but we need to keep an eye on all the drugs that are being tried and make sure that we're doing this really systematically.
Well, David Fagenbaum, I wish you continued good health. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Fagenbaum is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and executive director of the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network. His book is Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Benjamin Taylor's memoir about his friendship with Philip Roth. This is Fresh Air.
A rabbi, an Arab, and a comedian, all with COVID-19, walk into a luxury hotel.
There was a Zumba class, old, young, religious, secular, Arab, Jewish. I was like, where am I?
It's the Hotel Corona on NPR's Rough Translation.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
Benjamin Taylor says his close friend Philip Roth told him years ago, "We've laughed so hard, maybe we should write a book about our friendship." Taylor took up that suggestion, and the result is his new memoir about his friendship with Roth called Here We Are. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Imagine what Philip Roth would have made of this. That's what I said to my husband last month, or was it 2 months ago, during our extended family's first ever Zoom Passover Seder. We were the virtual hosts, and so we watched as, in groups or singly, family members materialized in their little Hollywood Squares cubes. The little kids waved and held up plastic frogs and locusts, while some of the older folks squinted into their laptops and fiddled with the audio, or pressed the wrong icon and vanished for a while altogether. Several times the service was delayed by anxious phone calls from senior family members requesting emergency tech support. In mixed marriage fashion, my husband and I took advantage of the situation and made ourselves Seder cups of gin and tonic instead of Manischewitz. Everyone genially agreed that the important thing about this shambling service was being together. Had Philip Roth lived long enough to witness pandemic Passover on Zoom, he would have been merciless. Roth died in 2018, leaving 31 books behind. Like other Roth lovers, I will always want more. Benjamin Taylor's new memoir, called Here We Are, temporarily eases the loss by giving us more of Roth's voice in conversation, brilliant, profane, and so very funny. Taylor was one of Roth's closest friends during the last decades of his life. In fact, Roth dedicated his 2007 novel, Exit Ghost, to Taylor. 20 years younger, gay, and himself an accomplished memoirist and novelist, Taylor assumes the role of Boswell to Roth's Dr. Johnson with ease. He's always aware, but only occasionally irritated, that Philip Roth is Philip Roth, and he's not. At the outset of Here We Are, Taylor tells us, "We spent thousands of hours in each other's company. He was fully half my life. I cannot hope for another such friend. To talk daily with someone of such gifts had been a salvation." Along with their conversations, in Here We Are, Taylor summons up anecdotes and clear-eyed assessments of what made Roth tick. There's an appealing quality of randomness to this slim memoir that makes it feel like we're tagging along with the two friends on their constant walks, talks, and dinners in the dive restaurants Roth preferred on the Upper West Side, where anything could come up, sometimes even big revelations. Taylor says that after Roth announced his retirement from writing in 2012, he stopped making art, but he still wrote, producing a manuscript of over 1,000 pages whose purpose was to air grudge after grudge. Taylor comments that the underside of Roth's greatness swarmed with grievances time had not assuaged. Taylor also recounts some of Roth's health struggles. Among other things, he suffered from back and heart problems. Taylor recalls one particular trip to the hospital with Roth where they jumped into a cab. The aggressively flatulent driver had Rush Limbaugh on at top volume. Roth, in pain, turned to Taylor and asked, "Are we to be spared nothing?" There's that voice, dry, droll, delighting in the human comedy and resigned to sometimes being the butt of its ongoing jokes. The greatest pleasure of Here We Are is hearing Roth's voice again new, especially when he's talking about his writing. At one point in their conversations, Roth says to Taylor that what he cares about in his work is individuals enmeshed in some nexus of particulars. "Philosophical generalization is completely alien to me. All my brain power has to do with specificity. Wouldn't know what to do with a general idea if it were hand-delivered. Would try to catch the FedEx man before he left the driveway. Wrong address, pal. Big ideas? No thanks." About his development as a novelist from his 1959 debut in Goodbye Columbus to Portnoy's Complaint, which was published in 1969, Roth confesses, "Oh, I wanted to be literary, wanted to be influenced. There were Flaubert and Henry James, Dreiser and Sherwood Anderson. But I discovered I was not a gloomy, but a raucous talent. And that's the story of Portnoy's Complaint, a full-scale farce with which to answer the abominations of the time, assassinations, cities afire, the nightly news from Southeast Asia. I flung my harmless obscenities back at the world historical ones." That last line stopped me cold and made me sorely miss the presence of Philip Roth in our world. What an epic Roth might have written, flinging Zoom satyrs, sheltering in place, Lysol and toilet paper against our present world historical obscenities.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Here We Are, My Friendship with Philip Roth by Benjamin Taylor. On tomorrow's show, what we can learn from the 1918 influenza outbreak, the deadliest pandemic in history. We talk with John Barry, whose 2004 book, The Great Influenza, is on the current bestseller list. He co-wrote a report on the future of the COVID-19 pandemic and lessons learned from the influenza pandemic. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. We had additional engineering help today from Mike Villers. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.